and then when Gore opened fire with the scoped blaster, charge in and finish off the wounded at point-blank range. The success of the scheme depended on Gore's accuracy with the Steyr. Egregious would have felt a lot better about the deal if the pack leader's hands had been steadier. As it turned out, he was worrying needlessly. Things never got to the charge and finish them off part. Neither Spadecrawler nor Egregious saw the minefield until it was too late. With the sound of rat traps snapping shut, more than 20 dirt-colored spheres the size of hen's eggs leaped from the ground. They jumped to various heights around Spadecrawler, all in a mid-chest to knees strike zone. As the mines rose in the air, they started to spin, and as they spun, they chittered like a flock of sparrows. Invisible to either of the startled cannies, around the equators of each of the little spheres were alternating laser firing ports and tiny mirrors. When the mines reached their designated maximum altitudes, the lasers fired in a precise sequence. They weren't targeted at living trespassers. They were aimed at the mirrors of the mines spinning opposite, which created a cat's cradle of zigzagging, reflected green light beams. Egregious watched as Spadecrawler stumbled through the fluttering, interlacing rays. He might as well have fallen into a web of bandsaws. Bloodlessly, he sizzled and came apart. The light show lasted for a second or two at most. As if on cue, all the spheres dropped back to the ground and were still. Egregious stood rooted to the earth, barely daring to breathe. Spadecrawler lay chopped into hundreds of pieces on the path in front of him. Even though he knew damn well the mines were on the ground around what was left of the man, he couldn't pick them out from the other rocks. He also knew if he didn't figure an escape plan, and quick, he was going to be down there in pieces too. The only jump-up mines he'd ever seen had had tripwire triggers. Assuming these chirping bastards were no different, the way he'd come in was clear. If he could just retrace his path, he'd be safe. But these mines were different. There was nothing so crude as a tripwire, and some were set to go off at second, third, or fourth contact instead of the first. Egregious took one step backward, and it was his last. As rat traps clattered shut all around him, and the triple deadly spinning spheres jumped up, he managed to get two words out.
Oh, shit.
And they hung in the air longer than he did. Crouched behind a pile of rubble about 100 yards from the Mutie camp on Main Street, Gore did a quick inventory through the Steyr's scope, and he liked what he saw. By itself, the fully functional all-terrain vehicle would bring enough jack to spell easy retirement for a canny with late-stage Uzis. No longer would the Right Reverend have to hunt down his own dinner. After today, he could afford to buy his meat, have it brought in live and on the hoof. He put the crosswires on one of the armored figures. The scope had a built-in rangefinder. Distance could be estimated by fitting the target between the horizontal marks, which were calibrated to the height of an average man at ranges from 100 to 800 meters. At the distance indicated by the finder, the Steyr's 7.62 millimeter by 51 round was a flat-shooting son of a bitch. The Muties did have a slight numerical advantage, but Gore was counting on the long blaster to change that in a hurry. The Scrounger's story about firing squads of Moon Boy's finest failing to drop these Muties, even if true, didn't really concern him. After all, there was a huge difference in muzzle velocities and knockdown power between black powder pistol balls and a slug fired from a metal-cased military rifle cartridge. Gore figured that headshots with 173-grain M118 bowtails would open up the backs of those greasy black helmets as if they were paper bags full of mashed yams. Because of the view angle he had, which was straight up the street, Gore couldn't see where Egregious and Spadecrawler were hiding, but he had a perfect view of Giggly Jane as she sidled, Jaybird naked, down the other end of Maine. When all five Muties turned to look at her, he had the jump on them, and he took it. The Steyr bucked hard against his shoulder. He rode the rifle's recoil wave, immediately bringing the scope back on target. The shot was a clean miss. He marked the dirt puff wide to the right.
Damn.
Cursing, he ejected the hull and chambered another round. Lucky for him, the triple stoop Muties were just standing there, like they didn't get the picture. He was about to give it to them in full color. Snugging the rifle tight to his shoulder, Gore adjusted his aim point for the degree of miss and fired again. On the other side of his target, the bullet kicked up dirt. Gore looked at his trigger hand. It wasn't shaking. It was rock steady. And there was no wind to push the bullets off track. Something had to be wrong with the scope's zero. Maybe the tube got bumped. Glad to see that the mutie still hadn't moved, Gore halved the distance of the last miss and squeezed off another shot. The slug veered to the right again, as if the bullets were being diverted around their intended target. That couldn't be fucking happening, he thought, as he frantically worked the bolt. As soon as the shooting started, Giggly Jane's job was done. Laughing hysterically, she dashed across the street and down a path between the shanties. She laughed even louder a few seconds later when she stumbled onto the three-dimensional puzzle that was all that was left of Spade Crawler and Jones. She was still laughing when the rat traps snapped and the jump-ups rose. A beam of green light flicked across her forehead and cut completely through her skull just above the ears, slicing her brain in two. Before her dead body could fall, 50 other laser beams reflected back and forth off the spinning mines, transected her torso and limbs in countless crisscrossing ways. Most of her hit the ground in neat 2-inch chunks. A fine gridwork of lime green appeared before Colonel Gebhardt's eyes. Though it seemed to be about a foot and a half from the tip of his nose, the map simulation was actually computer-projected on the inside of his helmet's visor. One of the squares at the extreme left side of the grid blinked on and off. They had more company. Gebhardt spoke to his battlesuit.
Key 19.
The gridwork display instantly dissolved, and he was looking through the lens of a motion sensor at the edge of their defensive perimeter. Four humanoid figures carrying crude projectile weapons made a stealthy approach from the west.
19 off.
Before resuming work on the rocket gantry, Gebhardt checked the elapsed time, which was projected in the upper right corner of his field of view. In exactly 22 minutes, the launch vehicle was going to pass through the rift. Because there was no direct communication with Earth from the shadow side, there was no way for him to stop the transfer. No way to speed it up, either. The comm blackout was a function of the structure of the pathway. It dictated that the entire operation be organized around a prearranged timetable. Accordingly, Gebhardt and his team were working on a tight and inflexible schedule. Time was also critical because existing technology and resources were being pushed to the limit. It took an unbelievable amount of power to create the pathway, and once it was in place, it had to be sustained, or there was no guarantee it would terminate in the same location when reconstructed. Each time the shadow end of the pathway was opened, it caused an even bigger power drain. On the Earth side, in an effort unprecedented in human history, countless millions were sacrificing their own comfort and safety for the sake of this expedition. Gebhardt was grateful for the rigid schedule. It kept his team focused on step-by-step details. There was no time to surrender to the gut-churning agoraphobia that the wide-open spaces produced. No time to stew over the terrible weight of their isolation, or of their responsibility to those who had sent them. No time to consider the danger. Though this wasn't supposed to be a suicide mission, it had plenty of potential for turning out that way, surrounded as they were by a vast uncharted territory full of unknown hazards. From the base of the mobile gantry, John Ackerman, the systems engineer, and Pedro Highlander, the biologist, had uncoiled the heavy, blast-proof ignition and telemetry cables from their spools and were dragging them across the street toward the ATV and launch control. Nara Jurashic, the team biochemist, and Marshall Connors, the geologist, stood beside the ATV, prepping its onboard computer for hookup. All electronic and software systems had to be triple-checked to make sure they had survived the crossing intact. Like Gebhardt, the others were soldier scientists, line officers blooded in the Consumer Rebellion of 2099, five volunteers selected out of a global human population teetering above 100 billion. They had been judged the best not just by their academic training or combat experience, but also by their biocompatibility with the latest generation of totality concept technology. The entire interior surface of the battlesuit was its control panel. Complete mastery of one's physical body, total muscular control, was required to operate the body armor at maximum efficiency. On top of that, Few human brains were capable of collating the avalanche of information the battlesuits provided, of shifting back and forth under the most extreme pressure between complex real and virtual environments, and in a fraction of a second, making critical